to having a relationship with a Russian agent. He says he was involved in an FBI investigation back in 2015 involving Russia, former presidential candidate Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump. Now, the company's stock price up 5% after Byrne steps down. Byrne, a guest on Bulls and Bears on Fox Business, with the bombshell claim the FBI's Peter Strzok involved in all of this.
I took some orders that seemed a little fishy in 2015, 2016. Last summer, watching television, I figured out the name of who sent me the orders, and this has all now been confirmed to me. The name of the man who sent me the orders was a guy named Peter Strzok.
Oh, my goodness.
Does that mean anything? Got it? Capiche?
Yeah.
So this is going to be quite a whirlwind.
Russian agent Maria Butina pleading guilty to conspiracy to act as an unregistered foreign agent and is serving 18 months in prison.
For USA Radio News, I'm Tim Berg.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Are you looking to get your message in front of a qualified audience through all the noise out there today? Consider taking an advertisement out on Hunterdon Chamber Radio, WHCR, DB, the voice of business. Contact the Chamber today at 908-782-7115 or give us an email at info@hunterdon-chamber.org.
Well, good afternoon on this cloudy, looks like rain Friday. Actually, probably most of you, like me, was somewhat surprised if you had not listened to the weather as to what was happening today as far as the temperature. Today and tonight, it's been cloudy. I don't think there's been any rain today, but we certainly are anticipating or could anticipate rain in some areas. The forecast, however, is tonight partly cloudy, low of about 58 degrees. Today it's been about 74 degrees, low humidity. Tomorrow should be sunny, beautiful day, high of about 78 degrees. Great day to get out and get things done around the yard. Not that insufferable heat that we've been having. By tomorrow night, partly cloudy and then mostly sunny on Sunday. High approximately 76 degrees, so both days will be very nice. And Sunday night, partly cloudy. High on Monday, it's about 75 degrees, partly sunny, then a slight chance of showers in the afternoon. Again, mostly cloudy on Monday night. So this weekend, both Saturday and Sunday, should really be nice weather, really great weather for most of us, unless you really like to have it 95 degrees and humid. So I'm Pat Smits, and the program which we're going to start is It's the Law. So what's happening legally? Somewhat slow in the summer, although there have been certainly been some interesting things that have been going on, if you're an attorney or just like to follow these things. One of the things that is kind of breaking news for those of you who are in corporations are following it, is today, Governor Phil Murphy conditionally vetoed a bill that would extend the state's controversial corporate tax program until January of next year. And he was doubling down on his push for a set of five new economic incentives. So he sent back Assembly Bill 5343, along with a 143-page veto message. I mean, that's not just, I'm not doing it. That's really a veto message that he wants everyone to take a look at, everyone in the legislature. And he said that he would only approve the bill if it included the five tax incentives that he proposed in October. Now, that was last October, obviously, so it's been almost a year. And his incentives would be capped at $400 million a year. and the legislative leadership has stood in opposition to those incentives, meaning that the State House and the governor's office could be in yet another political gridlock over the state's flagship incentives. So for the past 6 years, New Jersey has operated under a severely flawed tax incentive program that wasted taxpayer money on handouts to connected companies instead of creating jobs and economic growth. This is what Governor Murphy said in a statement announcing his conditional veto. So let me say that again. This is his position, is that for the past 6 years, New Jersey has operated under a severely flawed tax incentive program that wasted taxpayer money. This is a quote. No, it's not a quote. I'm sorry. It's his statement. And, yes, this is part of the quote. So he said a severely flawed tax incentive program that wasted taxpayer money on handouts to connected companies instead of creating jobs and economic growth, end quote. That was part of his statement announcing his conditional veto. So the what they call Grow New Jersey tax breaks and the Economic Redevelopment and Growth Gap Financing Program have both fallen under intense scrutiny. They expired on July 1st after Murphy declined to sign another assembly bill, which is the assembly bill that he just now conditionally vetoed. So he said in that statement today that both programs have worked only for a connected few, and that was his quote, connected few, end quote. When taking the same stance previously, he has cited the findings of a task force investigating the programs and said they allowed for lucrative tax breaks for companies to move to Camden despite little, if any, benefit going to residents in that impoverished city. So companies were getting huge tax breaks to go to Camden, but there was no finding that it was helping the residents of Camden. So one new economic incentive Murphy introduced was New Jersey Forward, NJ Forward, which would replace Grow NJ and would be capped at $200 million. And NJ Aspire, which would replace, again, a program ERG, and that would be capped at $100 million. So NJ Aspire would also provide bonuses to companies trying to eliminate the so-called, quote, food deserts, end quote, by constructing grocery stores in those neighborhoods. That provision added in months ago stands out following a Politico report this month that an amended to Grow NJ, which would ultimately kill plans for a Camden supermarket and deny tax breaks to that business, was made to benefit politically connected competitors in the state. So, I mean, that you always have to look in New Jersey as to who's getting the benefit and who's really being hurt by some of these things. So in addition, Governor Murphy also proposed an expanded, what he called the Brownfields, or not what he called, what's called the Brownfields Redevelopment Program. And that's aimed at refinancing redevelopment of contaminated urban sites and a historic preservation tax credit program. Both would each be capped at $20 million a year. I guess my only comment is I question how much really could be done if the sites that they're talking about are really contaminated. These are huge costs to deal with contamination, and especially I can imagine some of the contaminated sites in the urban areas. My only personal knowledge is not as an attorney here in New Jersey. However, I had a relative who owned an oil company, small oil company, in the Midwest. And I know the costs to just clean up a very small property was unbelievable. So in any event, the other thing that Governor unveiled is a $500 million Innovation Evergreen Fund. So it's called Innovation Evergreen Fund, and that's capped at $60 million a year. And that in that program, the state would split investments 50-50 with venture capitalists to fund life sciences, financial technology, digital media, and cybersecurity startups that were looking to open up in the state. Very interesting. Anybody interested, however, should really take a look at that program because the concern would be with opponents would be, you know, is this really going to be that helpful? But certainly the proponents think that it would be very helpful and that it would be a 50-50 contribution from the state and the venture capitalists. So the new programs go through July 1st, 2024. I'm sorry, 2024. According to the official veto statement, Murphy has until 4:30 p.m. Friday to sign, veto, or send back to lawmakers any legislation on his desk. Otherwise, the bills automatically become law. So now what we do know is that dozens of bills so far have fallen under the governor's pen. It is expected that Murphy will also conditionally veto a measure setting up an expungement process for certain marijuana offenses. And I think that certainly many young people, and not such young people, we'll be looking at that and why that is going to be conditionally vetoed. One of the concerns, of course, is the felony convictions for people who probably no longer are that young for marijuana offenses. And this would be a program and a bill. I have not read that bill, but that measure would be a process to enable people who were convicted of marijuana offenses, some of them, certainly not big cells, but certainly some of them, and that would give them the opportunity to expunge their records. And frankly, you know, it's a real concern. There are so many, and they're not necessarily young adults any longer, but so many adults who they're only offense, if we want to call it an offense, and it was. But some of the laws and some of the felonies, if you look into the criminal law, it was not, you know, possession and even distribution. People who were convicted of minor distribution, you know, they may have been 18, 18 and a half, 19 years old, and it has affected everything in their life, including the ability to borrow money to go to school. But in any event, the process would have them looked at, and I think that's the point, that it shouldn't be just everyone who's convicted, but there should be a process where it can take a look at the conviction, what it was, and whatever other factors would be considered that would enable people with certain marijuana offenses to have them expunged. So let me give you some sense of our sponsors. And then I'll be back and talk about more legal news.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HunterdonChamberRadio.com. Brought to you by the Hunterdon County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
Everybody over there!
Get on up!
Everybody out there!
Get into it!
Everybody out there!
Get involved!
Everybody, you!
Did you know? The Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in. Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterton-chamber.org. The Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Just want to give another shout out for NAMI Hunterton. If you have anyone in your family or know of anyone that has mental health problems, you know, contact NAMI. They have a variety of programs, very supportive, really good group of people, and dealing with mental health problems, addiction, and all of those problems in a family. Very, very stressful, very difficult. And it's hard to reach out, but they're the group to reach out to. So what else? Of course, I'm Pat Smits. I'm an attorney here in Hunterton County. I practice family law, and my practice is limited to family law and, you know, certain kind of expanded family law, guardianships and some other things, that, but problems with families. And certainly one of the things that I often do is talk to people and then refer them to another attorney. I had a call just yesterday from someone, but he really needed an attorney in Pennsylvania, and so that's what I did. I referred him to an attorney. Actually, it's an attorney here in New Jersey who practices in the area that this man needs an attorney in Pennsylvania as well as in New Jersey. So in any event, I think people should not be concerned about reaching out and talking to an attorney, calling an attorney. One of the things I find happens so often is that, you know, the person should have called me sooner or should have called another attorney sooner. And I know there's a lot of reluctance. However, you know, it's just so much better to be able to give advice before there's a catastrophe. So the other thing I wanted to talk about a little bit here is many of our listeners are conducting a business in the form of a sole proprietorship. Now, that shows up on your Form 1040 as a Schedule C. So those of you who have a sole proprietorship will be able to take a look and realize that you're filing a Schedule C, and you are operating, at least from a tax standpoint of view, it's among the simplest and least formal formats for a business. In fact, it's so informal that technically you don't need a separate bank account. You can run the income and expenses of that business through your personal account. Now, the reason is that from a tax point of view, the business is personal. In other words, to the taxing authorities, you know, you can, in fact, run it out of your personal account. However, while you can do that and do it that way, from a technical point of view, you should be urged not to do it that way. And some of the information that I receive on these issues is from Cal Barson, an accountant in Somerville, and this is one of his financial information and tax tips. So he would tell you, and I will tell you, that it behooves you to open a separate bank account and treat this side business or whatever it is as a separate business and respect the separate record-keeping requirements that are good practice for any business. So that, now one of the things that often people do, and I will acknowledge that I have done it and continue to do it, is sometimes I will pay personal bills out of my business account. Now I have a separate business account. And of course what this means is then my accountant has to figure out, or I have to tell my accountant which is business and which is personal. The other thing that I suggest people do, which I don't always do, is if you charge business expenses on a credit card, just keep that credit card for business expenses, because otherwise, on a monthly basis, I don't always do that. And so what I have to do on a monthly basis is categorize the expenses and determine which ones are business and which ones are personal. And, of course, sometimes it means if certain purchases are made from certain companies, there might be some personal items, there might be some business items. Makes it more complicated. So, in other words, Cal Barson and most of, I don't know of any financial planner who wouldn't tell you, or tax accountant, who would tell you that you should keep a separate business account and make sure that that is separate. And if not, make sure that on a regular basis you make a determination as to which are personal expenses and which are business expenses. In other words, you have to do more bookkeeping, not less. If you are audited by a tax authority, having a separate account makes the audit a lot simpler and likely that it will go smoother. Now, on the other hand, if you have that business's income and expenses go through your regular personal checking account, you now have to open up that account to an IRS auditor, which, according to Cal Barson, is simply inviting problems. So the less an auditor looks into your financial life, the better. While having a separate account won't guarantee hands-off of your personal account by the IRS, it will improve your chances dramatically. So if for no other reason, the chance of having an IRS audit would be the reason to keep your business and personal separate. Now, as I said, I don't use my personal account to pay business expenses, and with this warning, I'm going to have to take another look at whether or not I should pay any personal expenses out of my business account, even though I keep very good track of them and my accountant divides them at the end of the year when he's filing my taxes. So what else? Now there's apparently this Connecticut-based Cigna Corp is rumored to be exploring a potential sale of its group benefits insurance business, which apparently could be worth as much as $6 billion. So not sure how that would affect policyholders, but it's incredible the value that they place on some of these businesses. So that, there are a number of bills, as I said, that the governor has signed. Then he's conditionally vetoed them. There was a Mercer County case that settled for $4.1 million. Paraplegic man struck by a bus while crossing the street settled that case for $14.1 million. So, incredibly, nobody wants a $14.1 million settlement. They'd rather have their not have had the accident. So there was a there's a family law case that was published. It was a case with respect to sexual assault, and the trial court said the defendant, and there were two cases. One was the family court division of DCPMP, New Jersey Division of Child Protection and Permanency is DCPMP. Most of us still remember it as DIFAS, but now that's the new name. And there, so they will go to court. When they go to court, it's in the family court under a separate category. And however, in this case, the father, after the investigation, should have said it was stepfather. The DCPMP filed a complaint against him seeking custody and care of the children living in his home, alleging that his sexual abuse of one of his stepchild placed the children who lived with him in imminent harm. Now, he was also arrested and charged with sexual assault. And he retained a private attorney who was advised by the trial court that the attorney could not represent the defendant in both the criminal and what we call the Title IX. This was a Title IX case. And so the judge said he could not be represented by the same attorney in both matters. At a hearing, the attorney urged the trial court to follow another case in which the court held that dual representation could be permissible with implementation of protective orders and other measures to protect confidentiality of DCPMP records. So in this case, the court declined to consider any of the protective measures identified in the other case and disallowed defendant's counsel to engage in dual representation. So what happened is the defendant had his attorney continue in the criminal matter and applied for an appointed attorney in the Title IX matter. Now, following the trial in the Title IX matter, that's the DCPMP matter, the trial court found that defendant had abused or neglected the children. Now, then there was an appeal, of course, and on appeal, the defendant challenged various evidentiary decisions of the trial court, along with the decision to bar his attorney from dual representation. And the appellate division ruled that the trial court erred in denying the defendant his choice of counsel without considering steps to preserve the confidentiality. So not a good outcome from the standpoint of the DCPMP and the state, and the fact that this now has to go back and be done over. So that was the New Jersey Division of Child Protection and Permanency versus KG. And that's one of the, concerns always is the procedural issues and how the judge handles procedural issues. By the way, the D. Alameda wrote that opinion, and that was issued. Actually, it was issued. I guess it was issued a while ago. In June. There's a tax case, a real estate tax case, reported, and that was a case from. There were three tax court judgments affirming 2011 through 2013 tax assessments on the plaintiff's property, and that was Merrill Creek Reservoir. And so the defendant cross-appealed, arguing the tax court made errors in its adjustments to value of plaintiff's property. And the plaintiff's property included a reservoir and major improvements, including a dam, several small dikes, a spillway, conservation outlet, pipes, etc., etc., etc. Now, the reservoir was constructed by directive, actually to offset use by electrical power plants along the Delaware River during droughts. So at trial, the party stipulated that the highest and best use of the property was as a reservoir and that the fair market value of the land was $4.8 million. So what was the dispute? They disputed the fair market value of the improvements on the property, and specifically, the experts differed on the method of calculating the cost of reproducing or replacing the reservoir and its improvements. So the tax court ultimately concluded that the trend analysis cost approach used by the township's expert was most appropriate. Now, not sure, frankly, what the trend analysis cost approach is, but that's what the tax court judge said was most appropriate under the facts. So on appeal, the plaintiff conceded that the improvements on its property should have been valued according to the cost approach used by the tax court, but argued that the tax court erred by accepting the township's trend analysis. And the plaintiff contended that it was a rarely used valuation methodology, and it was discredited by precedents. Well, I can tell you, it certainly is rarely used. I'm not a real estate lawyer, and I haven't handled that kind of situation. However, I'm fairly routinely get involved in business valuations. And at least I've never heard of that valuation method. So in this case, however, the appellate division, and this was written by Judge Accurso, very well-respected appellate court judge, someone who was on the trial at the trial level, and very smart, very astute. And so in the opinion that she wrote, she affirmed the use of trend cost analysis approach due to the special purpose nature of the property and rejected plaintiff's assertion that the method had been discredited by legal precedent. So the appellate division ruled that the method was appropriate given testimony that the reservoir would be built the same way today as it was originally built in the 1980s. And the availability of detailed financial records from the reservoir's construction, that availability gave them the information they needed. And finally, the appellate division ruled that the court's application of a deduction for functional obsolescence was not reversible error. So basically, they did not make either side happy. But in this case, based on this very specialized property, the court agreed that that was, in fact, the trend cost analysis approach was the best way to decide this. Well, let me take a short break. I was hoping that John Manfreda might come in and talk about some issues with respect to estates and some of the law that's coming about and the cases recently in that area. I'm still hoping he might make it. I know he had an appointment, so perhaps he won't be here until it's time for the sports guys, which is fine. But let's take the breaks now, and in case he gets in, we can finish out without any more spots from our sponsors. Not that we don't like you all. We do.
Did you know that 1 in 5 people are affected by mental illness? NAMI Hunterdon is the locally affiliate for NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We are all volunteers, and all our programs are free of charge. We offer Family to Family, a 12-week course for families that have an adult member with a mental illness. Another popular program is In Our Own Voice, where individuals who are living with mental illness discuss their challenges and their progress in overcoming those challenges. Another course we offer is Basics, a 6-week course for families with a child or an adolescent who has experienced mental illness. We also have a monthly support group for families on the third Thursday of every month. Please call NAMI Hunterton at 908-284-0500 for more information about any of our programs or to join. NAMI Hunterton, the voice for mental health in Hunterton County.
You're listening to WHCR-DB, HuntertonChamberRadio.com, brought to you by the Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
Hello, this is Nicole Smith, host of Happy to Help. Would you like to discover the secret to happiness? I talk to volunteers, executive directors, fundraisers, and authors about how nonprofit engagement enriches their lives. We thrive when we have a sense of purpose in our lives. Philanthropy is the new community. Tune in to Happy to Help every Wednesday at 10 a.m. to discover how to find your purpose and live well by doing good.
Did you know the Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce has over 20 active committees that you can participate in? Committees range from focus on business and government to economic development to events like our annual business expo. Contact the Chamber for more information today at 908-782-7115 or email us at info@hunterton-chamber.org. The Hunterton County Chamber of Commerce, the voice of business.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg completed a 3-week course of treatment for a pancreatic tumor. The news comes after Ginsburg was treated for lung cancer late last year. On Friday, China announced that there would be a tariff hike on $75 billion worth of U.S. goods. In retaliation, President Trump says U.S. companies should look for alternatives to Chinese manufacturing. All of this has many people concerned, but White House trade advisor Peter Navarro tells Fox Business that most people agree with the president's posture.
We are all China hawks now in this country, and whether it's Mike Pompeo or Chuck Schumer or a Harvard Harris poll that says the public is behind President Donald J. Trump standing up to China as the chosen one.
And you're listening to USA Radio News.
You knew the risks when you decided to drive drunk. There could be a crash. People could get hurt or killed. But that didn't stop you, did it? You knew you could get arrested. You could incur huge legal expenses. And you could possibly even lose your job. You were well aware of the consequences of driving drunk. But one thing's for sure. You were wrong when you said it was no big deal. Drive sober or get pulled over. This message brought to you by NHTSA.
Now you can fly anywhere in the world and pay discount prices on your airline tickets. Book a flight today to London, Paris, Madrid, or anywhere else you want to go. And pay a lot less guaranteed. Call the International Travel Department right now at Low Cost Airlines.
800-215-5141. 800-215-5141. That's 800-215-5141.
Well, good afternoon. I'm back and just trying to find some what might be some interesting reports on cases that have been published. There's one, OPEX Realty Management, LLC, landlord-tenant case versus Taylor. And the plaintiff filed suit to evict the defendants, they were tenants, for non-payment of late and legal fees. And the apartment was subject to Newark's rent-controlled ordinance. They lived in Newark.
And the defendants cured the what they call the summary dispossess by paying the overdue monthly rent into escrow. However, they challenged the plaintiff's charging of late fees and legal fees as additional rent. The defendants argued that the addition of late and legal fees was as additional rent would cause their total rent to exceed the maximum rent allowed by the rent control ordinances. And in this case, this was in the law division, and Judge Petrillo noted that the written lease had to expressly permit a landlord to recover late and legal fees in a summary dispossessed proceeding before the court could consider those expenses as additional rent. However, the court also noted that court rules provided that even if a lease contains such a provision, the amount of rent that might be due could be limited by local rent control ordinances. And the court held that rent was defined in the newer ordinances, including any any bonus benefits or gratuity demanded or received for or in connection with the use or occupancy of housing space or the transfer of a lease such as housing spaces. So the court found that other courts had previously liberally construed the Newark Ordinance's definition of rent to include items such as damage charges, although the court noted that attorney's fees were not expressly included in the definition of rent. It held that the rent control ordinances provisions indicated that the Newark government intended to disallow such expenses as a cost for applying for rent increases. So as a result, the court ruled that the rent control ordinances did not exempt legal costs from rent. And the court ruled that the late and legal fees could not contractually be labeled as additional rent and then have the term disavowed to avoid the rent control ordinance. So, you know, this is very limited, this decision very limited to situations where there is a rent control ordinance and not something we generally find, you know, out here in Hunterdon County. So it the New Jersey Appellate Court ruled that a trial judge hearing a legal malpractice lawsuit lacked jurisdiction when he trimmed the plaintiff's side legal fees from $2.1 million to $359,000. Had to be some unhappy attorneys there. Well, there's a proof of publication, a juvenile case, and I guess all parents are concerned that, you know, they may have a child. Well, not all parents, but some parents are concerned. So what this case, and this was a Chancery Division, and the Probation Division issued a report and recommendation that the matter be returned to court for the juvenile because of TD, and they use initials, and it would be in the interest of TD, and TD's failure to complete community service ordered by the court. So he was then a 17-year-old juvenile, entered an admission to one count of shoplifting and one count of obstruction of the administration of law. Now, the shoplifting, you know, unfortunately, there are probably more parents that would than would like to admit it could be involved in a case where a teenager was shoplifting. But since we now have John Manfredo, who just walked in, we're going to get a big hello from him. And instead of talking about shoplifting, we're going to talk about something that's certainly more interested, or I should say interesting. I think that's mic three, John.
That is what I'm checking. Good afternoon, everybody. It is mic three. Pat, good afternoon. And I am fresh in from the ophthalmologist with eyes dilated, so I barely can see where I'm going, barely got here. But, folks, I knew if I didn't get here like I promised Pat I would, that she would divorce me as her friend. I know that's a terrible pun play on Pat's forte as a matrimonial attorney. But what Pat wanted me to speak about very briefly today was just how important it is for those litigants in the family court, in the family part, in matrimonial action, to have their estate plan reviewed. And typically, Pat, we suggest it be done twice, at the inception of the action, just to see where you're at, because you can't change anything substantively generally, but you might be able to. There may be other things that you can do. But more importantly, if there's younger children involved and there is insurance that is imposed as a condition of either the PSA or just the court orders it, we recommend that that policy be held in a trust arrangement, A, that's sheltered from creditors, B, it's sheltered from taxes, and more importantly, if it's insurance on your life, then you will be able to control that, or your designated trustee will be able to control it, rather than your soon-to-be former spouse.
And what I can say is so often, and I'll look at agreements that have been done by other attorneys, and they really don't understand the importance of that type of planning for children. I mean, so often
that's the key.
It just says life insurance should be maintained.
Right, Pat. And sometimes, Pat, will even say husband is ordered to maintain a policy of insurance of $1 million in trust for the children, and that's it. It doesn't go on to detail the trust. There is no trust, and we wind up back litigating that issue later on. And in the event that the husband were then to pass away, I mean, it's always better to have the coverage, have the money, and then just fight about who's going to control it. So don't let it impede your progress. The first thing you should do is go out and get coverage. There's no question about that. The question is, when you're speaking with that insurance agent, and Pat and I both know an excellent agent to work with in that regard, but that agent needs information and instructions regarding how that policy should be structured within a trust arrangement. And, Pat, that's so important for the benefit of the kids.
And the other thing that I find, and it's amazing to me, how many people come to me and they do not have a will.
There's no planning. They not even have life insurance, and it's in this day and age that's a big mistake.
Well, one of the things that I would say to younger people is that they should have life insurance only because no one knows when you might have some kind of an illness or an injury that you're no longer going to be able to get life insurance.
Correct. And that's a very good point.
I really thought that the maximum was about 20 years for term policies. And I've heard
we just found out the other day that you can they go into 25 and even 30 years.
So that means a very inexpensive policy. And it really is, if someone's in good health and young, they can get a lot of insurance. And you might find the same thing when you're talking about people in their estate planning. They'll say, well, but I'm just wasting the money if I don't die. But the whole point is that for not a lot of money, they're making sure that their children will be able to, you know, go to college and do all the other things and be supported. And other clients will say to me, oh, well, if I die, my children will have Social Security.
Which is nice, but it's not going to replace hundreds of thousands of dollars of insurance coverage.
Right. And, of course, the other thing that I will say to my clients is, hey, look, if you go out and get insurance now, you'll be able to not only name the beneficiaries, name the children in trust as the beneficiaries of the policy, but also you'll be able to name the trustee.
Correct, and that's the element of control I was referring to a moment ago. The idea being that, for example, if I'm the husband, divorcing spouse, and I'm the insured, I can create the trust, designate, you know, my brother, my sister, my best friend to be the trustee. So when those insurance proceeds are paid in, that person who I, the trusted person who I've selected to handle that trust, can make sure that those proceeds are truly used for the benefit of the children. Because as you know, Pat, all too frequently the insurance is turned over. I mean, I've seen this in my estate planning practice, turned over to a surviving spouse, and God knows where that money winds up. The kids later, when they hit 20 or 25, when they're supposed to get a distribution, they're told, oh, well, we use the money to support you. When that's not supposed to be, because typically, unless you word the PSA differently and depends on the ages of the kids, there's an affirmative duty of support already with that surviving spouse, the mom in this case. Well, so perhaps some of that money should be used for support, or maybe summer programs, private school or something. I can understand that. But you want to structure it so that they will be, let's say, at age 25 or 30, when that child is, you know, blooming into young adulthood, will get a nice distribution from that trust. It's the least you can do for them, since they've had to go through those years without a dad.
Right. Well, let me, because I try to put a specific language in a property settlement agreement, but let me ask you another question. How do you handle it when you're doing estate planning for a couple? And I'm saying this because it's not always true, but let's assume that one of the spouses, the wife, is really not very sophisticated financially. But should she be the trustee? In other words, what do you tell people? How do you counsel
people? Good question. Yeah, we basically have a strong preference for professional trustees these days, because the job of trustee is relatively complex. The trust arrangement itself is not that complex. Even in a revocable trust, tax-sheltered trust, those are fairly standard instruments, and the benefit is for the children. The key to it is the investment piece and the tax treatment. And you need professional advice for that, Pat. Some people say, well, I'll name the spouse and then they'll just hire an accounting firm or a law firm to do the heavy lifting. The problem is that they will be charged a significant premium by those professionals to render that advice, whereas the trustees' commissions under New Jersey law are very reasonable. So both for expertise and economy, you are better off designating a professional. And it could be the professional standing alone, or many clients, Pat, will say, but I don't want a professional trustee such as a bank trust company telling me what to do. Well, you could arrange for a co-trusteeship. You could have one spouse be co-trustee with the professional trustee. The only thing that the spouse co-trustee couldn't participate in would be decisions related to principal invasion. And that would always be a discretionary factor in the hands of a impartial trustee. So it's a nice package that way. It's a great question, and we have a good answer for it, which is, you know, get the right people in line. It's good to have a nice trust prepared. It's a wonderful thing to do, but the right people have to run it to get the benefit from it.
Right. Well, and my advice has always been have an individual and, you know, a bank or someone.
Bank trust company. And there are trust companies out there that just specialize in trustee arrangements. Garden State Trust Company, and we have one right here at Hunterdon County with Kurt Talkie, a great trust officer, knows how to do these things. It's not beyond the realm of possibility they will handle a special needs trust. They will tailor that trust for your needs. Bank trust departments such as Bank of America, PPAC Gladstone Bank, can handle more significant situations that go beyond mere trust arrangements. And so the thing to do, again, is to get advice from your attorney as to which trust company would be appropriate.
And I absolutely agree. The one thing that it was amazing to me that a few people have said to me, well, I'm afraid to use a
a bank because they'll be too conservative.
Well, on the investment side, Pat, they will be as liberal or as conservative as you want them to be. If you set up a traditional trust with traditional distribution standards, they will typically sit with the spouse. Let's say I die.
Well, let's assume that they're the only trustee. That's why.
Oh yeah, and they will sit with the. But that's why they will sit and say, "Well, here's the portfolio we recommend." Which, let's say, there's a $500,000 in the trust, and they will predict, let's say, a 5% return. So that's $25,000 of income. If she needs $40,000 of income, well, they will invest in other things. They'll conform that portfolio to get the result that she needs. So it's not going to be ultra conservative, and there's not going to be enough income from the trust. That I'm not sure that ever existed, but I've heard that question before. Generally, if you're working with the right trustee, a good trust company, they will do everything they can. That's their job, to make you comfortable.
Right, and the people will say, well, I don't have any assets of any significance, but. What people do forget is if they've done their planning to include life insurance.
Then it could be very significant.
And I always laughed. I said most people are worth more dead than they are alive.
That's true. It's a joke, but it happens to be true. And Pat, I know we're running out of time. I promise I'll come back and expand on this another time. We haven't done it in quite a while. And I think a lot of your listeners will find it very useful as an adjunct to the other legal topics that you're discussing, particularly with respect to matrimonial family law decisions.
Right. And I think that everyone out there at least needs to talk to someone like John. John is an estate planning attorney.
Talk to anybody. I know what I'm doing, and we do it well, but talk to anybody and get into the hands of somebody
right.
who knows what they're doing, who specializes in estate planning.
And
Pat, one last thing. If nothing else comes out of this conversation, anybody with young children should have a will, trust provisions, guardianship provisions, life insurance, and if they're getting divorced, a properly structured PSA to make sure that spouse and those children are covered.
Right. But before that, before everybody, while everybody is very happy, again, if you have children, and one of the things that people have said to me is, well, we had everything agreed to, but we couldn't agree who would be the guardian of our children if something happens to both of us. You must get this plan because the other thing in New Jersey, well, two things. I'm not an estate planner. I don't do this.
But you understand guardianship work, Pat.
But I also understand that without a will, it's going to be much more expensive to probate.
Yes.
And
you may have to post an administrator's bond.
Exactly.
Whereas the will can waive the posting of the bond. That saves a couple of the. Typically, ironically, Pat, the cost of doing an estate plan is outweighed by the cost of having to post the administrator's bond if you die without a will.
Right. And then the second thing, and I know people use the internet, but.
Oh, big mistake.
Big mistake in New Jersey if you try to go on the internet to write a will. New Jersey has some very specific.
Very idiosyncratic.
That's the best word I could hear about that. Very idiosyncratic. And it, as John said, it's really not that expensive to do a will. It might be very simple, but the point is anyone who goes on the internet to try to do some kind of a downloading of a will, I mean, big mistake.
Yeah, and again, once again, if somebody is consulting a family law attorney such as Pat about related issues, it's an imperative that you have your estate plan looked at. Family law is very, very good to get the result you want, but there's unintended consequences when you don't have the plan in place on the estate side should something go wrong, whether it's you or your spouse, because spouse, somebody could die before that plan, before the litigation is over. If you're thinking about, filing for divorce, there needs to be planning up front. Not significant planning. Believe me, Pat, it's actually very simple, but it needs to be done.
Yes, I agree. Well, we'll be back. We're going to
play the news, and then John and I will be back with the sports guys.
Thank you, Pat.
USA Radio News with Tim Berg.
The Trump administration is moving to implement a regulation that would allow the government to indefinitely detain illegal migrant families crossing into the U.S. illegally. Friday on Fox and Friends, U.S. Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost outlined the way the new rule would be implemented.
These families are going to be held in ICE custody in family residential centers. I want to be clear that they are not going to be held in Border Patrol stations. So that frees up my agents first and foremost. They also are going to be held until they can have a fair trial and get in front of a judge and make their case. And that is expected to be somewhere between 40 and 60 days.
Stocks plunged after President Trump suggested U.S. companies find alternatives to doing business in China. The Dow lost 623 points to close at 25,629. The NASDAQ and S&P also fell. And you're listening to USA Radio News.
You knew the risks when you decided to drive drunk.